Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Of Ishapanishad, just one point I want to bring to your attention about one thing I said yesterday. The Ishapanishad is actually part of the Yajur Veda. I said Atharva Veda, I'm sorry. As we read yesterday about the defects of the conditioned soul to make mistakes. What a mistake. Prabhupada makes reference to this in one of the earlier verses. Oh, it's in the purport of Mantra 1. Prabhupada makes the point that Ishapanishad is part of Yajur Veda. Okay, so this is speeding back a little. Okay, so we were on, what was it, page 8 of the introduction, Roman numerals B1 III 8. We had been through the points made in the first paragraph of our little synopsis on page 3 of the overview book, and we're moving on to the second paragraph, heading in that direction at least. Prabhupada makes the point, and it's an important point, between or at the beginning of page 9, that the Vedas are not compiled by human beings, and therefore we accept that they don't have those four defects which are very common or totally universal characteristics of humans. So, and the Vedas are also dealing in many respects with subject matters which are beyond our perception anyway. It's truly superhuman or transcendental information. Transcendental literally means above and beyond your senses. That is transcendental. So in a certain sense, what is, for our sense of sight, what is going on the floor above the ceiling here is transcendental to our sense of sight. So if there are subject matters, important subject matters particularly, which are beyond your sensory capabilities, then you have to have some source of knowledge which is on that level and is able to actually transmit information about that realm, that subject matter. And Srila Prabhupada makes very interesting point, which I think we all know very well. If you want to know who your father is, then you have to ask your mother, because it's beyond your sense. So in a similar way, the Vedas are taken to be the mother, Shruti. This is at the top of page 9 of the introduction. Shruti is considered to be like a mother. We take so much knowledge from our mother. So, yeah, our background, our family background like that, we have no way of seeing that. It's already happened before we appeared. But we can ask our mother, and she can tell us. So there's so much information about who we are and what we are and where we belong and so on, how it is we're entangled here, how to get out of the entanglement here and go back to Godhead. But that's beyond us in terms of just our own ability to perceive and understand directly. So this information we get from the Vedas. The Vedas are like the mother, and Brahma is like the grandfather. So, let's see. Then down the bottom of page 9, Srila Prabhupada starts talking about the three kinds of evidence. We did refer to this a bit yesterday. Pratyaksha, Anuman, and Shabda. So, actually there are more ways of acquiring knowledge, according to the Vedas. We're not going to go into them all, but these are the three which we accept as Vaishnavas. We accept Pratyaksha, direct sensory perception, seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting. We accept that as a means for acquiring knowledge. Then Anuman, we mentioned yesterday, and one of the Matajis was saying that there was no sort of explanation directly in the purple, in the introduction. But if you look on page 12, just jumping ahead a couple of pages, page 12 of the introduction, towards the top there, Prabhupada refers to, you'll see in the fourth line down, the deductive process. So this is Anuman, inference. You deduce that this is like this and this is like that, so therefore something else is like something. This is inference. And in fact, Prabhupada uses the example that we used yesterday. Your father says man is mortal. Your sister says man is mortal. Everyone says man is mortal. You don't need to experiment. So this is inferring. This is the idea. Man is mortal. Socrates is a man. So Socrates is mortal. Inference. So we accept Pratyaksha, direct perception. Did everyone mark themselves present? Anyone not mark themselves present? We accept direct perception. We accept inference. Then there's Shabda. Shabda means hearing from the Vedic literatures particularly, or hearing from a bona fide representative of the Vedic literatures. This is Shabda. Transcendental sound, this very reliable source of information, the Vedas. The Vedas are Shabda. And anyone who repeats the Vedas is also producing Shabda. So we accept the three, but when one or two, direct perception or inference, conflict with Shabda, then we accept Shabda. This is how we... I mean, it's not that we just accept direct experience, we just accept inference. These things actually, they need to be confirmed by Shabda. And if there's any conflict, we accept Shabda. Like, for example, it's a very simple example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains right at the beginning that we're all spirit soul. And we, of course, accept that as devotees. But, you know, many surgeons and people like that dissect human bodies and, you know, take them to pieces. And I don't think any of them have found a soul yet. So on the basis of direct sensory perception, these surgeons and people could all say that, no, no, there's no soul. We didn't see one. We saw everything. We didn't see a soul, though. But Shabda says there is a soul. So we accept that. Because Shabda, among other things, Shabda has access to this transcendental realm of awareness, which our senses don't have access to. So this is the idea. We accept all three, but the first two have to be confirmed by Shabda, and if there's a conflict, we accept the Shabda. So Srila Prabhupada goes on, and then on page 11, in order to... Prabhupada's making the point that we accept Krishna as authority. This again is addressing the issue which we discussed a bit yesterday. Why do we accept the Vedas as being authoritative? You know, who is giving the stamp of approval which we are meant to accept? So first of all, we can say that Krishna does. But then you might say that, well, you know, Krishna, we've never seen Krishna. He sounds like a rather fantastic character. So why should we accept Krishna? So then Srila Prabhupada mentions a number of more sort of, I don't know what, down-to-earth types of authorities, you might say, or at least there, anyone would accept them as real historical persons. Ramanuja, Madhvacharya, Vishnu Swami. So they're very important and famous philosophers and saintly people and big scholars. And they accept Krishna. They're not just foolish people. And even on the other side, they're Vaishnavas, of course. On the other side, you've got the Mayavadis, who are at odds with the Vaishnavas in many ways. But even the leader of the Mayavadis, Shankaracharya, even he accepts Krishna. Narayana Parovyaktat. Those are famous words from Shankaracharya himself. Bhajagovinda, 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 Mudhamate. I forget the rest of the word first, but he's saying, telling his followers, just worship Govind, just worship Krishna, and don't worry about all this word jugglery which I've trained you in. So these fairly diverse persons, but they're all in their own rights, in their own fields, they're big, big authorities. They also accept the Vedas. So we can have faith in them and accept their idea, and we can accept the Vedas. So, then going over to page 12, Srila Prabhupada, in the second paragraph on page 12, makes reference to a well-known verse in Brahma Samhita about how Krishna, or the spiritual realm, is way beyond us. The idea is that you can travel at the speed of the mind for a long time, many years, but still you won't get any closer to Krishna, because he's not approached in those, like, geographical, very mundane terms. Speed of the mind means, Prabhupada would say, he was in America, and he said that now, there's a nice conversation actually, Srila Prabhupada, with one lady in Prabhupada, just when Prabhupada had first arrived in New York. And this lady was telling Srila Prabhupada that, I can see you miss your home. And Srila Prabhupada, I don't know if you've heard that tape, it's very nice conversation. Sasarup Maharaj played it in his course last year. This lady is being sympathetic in a mundane but nice way to Prabhupada. I can see you're homesick. You're missing your home. And Srila Prabhupada says, yes, I miss Vrindavan. And I think of it a lot. And then he says that, I'm thinking of Vrindavan and I'm there. I'm there. That is the speed of the mind. So that's the speed of the mind. You can be sitting in New York and you can be in Vrindavan in an instant. Not even a second, just a fraction of a second. You can be in Vrindavan, which is some thousands of miles away. So in Brahma Samhita, Lord Brahma says that if you want to approach Krishna, if you want to have access to Krishna, then you could try traveling at the speed of the mind for many, many years. long time, millions of years. So, you would have gone an awfully long way by material standards, millions of years at the speed of the mind. But you won't have got any closer to Krishna. It's not that you will have moved one inch or, one millionth of the way, something like that. You actually won't have got any closer. So that process in general is defective and it won't work. So we don't use that process, mundane process, speculating with the mind. And it's called Aroha Panta. Is it? The word is used somewhere here. Aroha means the ascending process, and Avaroha means the descending. Oh, here it is. It's right in the middle of page 12. This process of researching, speculating, trying to access Krishna in that way. This process is called in Sanskrit Aroha, the ascending process. So we take the descending process. The descending process, we're still in the second paragraph. We say it must be received through the bona fide channel of the Guru Parampara, coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna himself. So down at the bottom of page 12, Srila Prabhupada, about this descending process, getting knowledge, coming down through disciplic succession, Prabhupada is paraphrasing, he's indirectly quoting a very important verse, which he would quote as such frequently. He says, therefore the Vedic injunction is that one must approach. The word compulsory is used, a bona fide spiritual master, a guru. And what is the qualification of a spiritual master? He has rightly heard the Vedic message from the right source. Otherwise, he's not bona fide. He must practically be firmly established in Brahman. These are the two qualities. So just to wake any of you up who are having difficulty staying awake spontaneously, may not be on the spontaneous platform yet. Who can tell us what is that verse? It's Mundaka Upanishad. No. That's Sweta Ashvatara Upanishad. Oh, very good. Yes. Tad Vigyanartam Sagurum Eva Bigachet Samit Pani Shotriam Brahma Nishtam. Mundaka Upanishad 1.2.12. In order to learn the transcendental science, one must approach the bona fide spiritual master in disciplic succession, who is fixed in absolute truth. Well, that's a sort of slightly paraphrased translation. But he must be Shrutriyam, he must have heard, and Brahmanishtam, he must be fixed in Brahman. And the term is Eva Abhigachet. Abhigachet means you must approach, you must come to him, and Eva means you must. Imperative. So this is the system. This is the system of receiving the Vedas, or receiving knowledge, really, through the disciplic succession. Then, over onto page 13, right at the bottom. Oh, well, anyway, on page 13, the main body of text there, Prabhupada is talking about how Krishna is beyond our senses. He is unlimited, and if we try and find him by research, just won't work. It just won't work. Krishna, when he was on this planet, he had children, then he had grandchildren, a multitude, 161,080 children, and 1,610,800 or something like that grandchildren. And he had great-grandchildren too. So, but he looked like a 16-year-old boy. So when you hear things like this, you think, oh, okay, fine. Some sort of mumbo-jumbo or mythology. But actually it's true. It is a fact. But the thing is, in order to accommodate this, you have to adjust yourself to the descending process. You have to be ready for that. And then you'll hear things like this and you'll think, oh right, fine. And you won't get put off or become confused. So it's very important because we're dealing with subject matter. This submissive attitude of hearing and accepting in disciplic succession is extremely important. Practically the most important thing, actually, that one can submissively hear and absorb the bona fide teachings which are actually coming in the bona fide line. And then you don't have to be a big genius or a great renunciate or a big philosopher. You just, even a child can do it. Just become the humble servant of the servant. So then Srila Prabhupada goes on from the bottom of page 13. We're now in paragraph 3 of our introduction in the overview book. A bit of the history of the Vedas. Oh, we mentioned this yesterday. Originally there was only one Veda, but Vyas divided it. That Veda, in fact, was called Yajurveda. But then Vyas divided it. So he's called Veda Vyas. Vyas means divider. That is the literal translation of the word Vyas. So Veda Vyas means he who divided the Veda. Singular. Veda Vyas. He divided the Veda into its various divisions, taking into consideration the nature of the audience. So he manifested the four Vedas, and then for the benefit of Stri, Sudra, Dwija, Bandhu, Nam, all sorts of people who are less competent. So he presented the same message, but in a way that was very attractive to such people in the form of Mahabharata and the Puranas, which are in the form of stories, which are very, you know, attractive for practically anyone. But at the same time, they have the same knowledge. It's not that they're less. Actually, in one sense, they're even more. Particularly Srimad Bhagavatam, Vedanta Sutra, and then Srimad Bhagavatam. So, in this way, we come to the end of the introduction, and we're now going to go on and let's turn over to page 4 of our overview book, and we give a little summary of the overview. You'll see we've divided, there are 19 mantras, the invocation and 18 mantras 1 to 18. So we've divided them up according to the different themes which are focused on in different groups of mantras. We've divided them into 5 sections. The first is invocation and mantras 1 and 2, then mantra 3, then mantras 4 to 8, mantras 9 to 14, and then mantras 15 to 18. So what I propose to do now is that we can all recite these mantras section by section and just have a look at the translations, and then we'll see how the different mantras are fitting into the different sections. So if you could open up your Ishapanishads on page 1, the invocation. And you can repeat after me. Om Purnamada Purnamidam.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam.
Purna Purnamidam.
Purnamudachyate.
Purnasya
Purnamadaya.
Purnam Eva Vashishyate.
Translation. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he's completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is the complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. Then mantra one, it's on page 4.
Ishavasyamidam sarvam.
Yatkincha
jagatyam
jagat.
Tena tyatena
bunjita.
Magridha kasya
svidanam.
Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which is set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. And then mantra 2, which is on page 10.
Kurvan eveha karmani.
Jivashat
chatam sama.
Evam
twaina
nyate
tosti.
Na karma lipyate
nare.
One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way. For that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man. So we've put these verses together. The little summary I gave, you'll see there, four of the overview book, we've said that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and therefore his creation is too. He has perfectly made arrangements for all living beings, and if we learn to live according to his arrangements, we can live happily on the spiritual platform, even in this material world. That is the basic message there. It's giving like a very fundamental definition of reality. What is this universe, this world in which we're living, and how we can find our place in it and be happy and everything will be perfect. Okay, so let's go on to mantra 3. It's on page 14. We've put this mantra in its own section on its own. And we've said in the overview book, summarize that those who abuse the opportunity of the human form of life have a very dim future.
Asurya namate
loka.
Andena
tamasavrita.
Tamste pretya vigacchanti.
Yeke
chatma
hanojana.
The killer of the soul, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets known as the worlds of the faithless, full of darkness and ignorance. As we mentioned yesterday, the speaker, I'm not sure who it is, but the speaker is using strong language. The killer of the soul. Atma Hana. Killers of the soul. So the next section is, the Supreme Lord is the greatest person and possesses unique characteristics. Within him, all contradictions are resolved. The pure devotees see everything and everyone in relation to him and are therefore completely free from anxiety on the transcendental platform. By rendering devotional service in this consciousness, they realize him directly.
anejarekam manaso javiyo.
Naina
deva apnuvan purvam arshat. Tadavaton yanat yeti tishtat. Tasmin apo matarishva didhati.
Although fixed in his abode, the personality of Godhead is swifter than the mind and can overcome all others running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him. Although in one place, he controls those who supply the air and rain. He surpasses all in excellence. So we see how unique Krishna is. He's a like conflicting, apparently conflicting types of characteristics. And the same theme continues in Mantra 5 on page 22.
Tadejati tam naijati tadure tadvantike tadantarasya sarvasya tadu sarvasyasya bhayata.
The Supreme Lord walks and does not walk. He is far away, but he is very near as well. He is within everything, and yet he's outside of everything. Again, very extraordinary, very unique. And Mantra 6 on page 27.
Yastu sarvani bhutani. Atmanyeva nupasyati. Sarva bhuteshu chatmana. Tato na vijugupsate.
He who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything nor any being. So as Srila Prabhupada mentions in the first sentence of the purport, this is a description of the Mahabhagavat, the great personality who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the great devotees, advanced devotees, they can actually accommodate these diverse concepts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead without becoming confused. But rather they think, oh, very nice, just see how wonderful our Lord is. Just like, you know the story of the cobbler and the Brahmin, I suppose, in Narada Muni? Well-known story. Anyone not know that story? Well, extremely briefly, there was a cobbler and a Brahmin, and they both asked Narada Muni, who was on his way to see Lord Narayan, when they were going to go back to Godhead. So he asked, and Lord Narayan told him that the Brahmin will take an awfully long time. He's a very puffed up Brahmin, thought he was very intelligent and expert and so on. So Lord Narayan said, oh, it'll take an awfully long time. But the cobbler, who was a devotee, and very humble, very simple devotee, the Lord said, oh, at the end of this life, he'll come back to me. Very soon. And then Lord Rand told them that if they asked you what I was doing when you were here, tell them I was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. So when he went back and told the Brahmin that he was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. And the Brahmin said, what nonsense. No one can thread an elephant through the eye of a needle. So then Narada understood, yes, just see. This is why this man is not going back to Godhead soon. And then he went to the cobbler and told him, actually, you're going back to Godhead at the end of this life. The cobbler was very happy. And then Narada remembered, oh yes, I better tell him this thing. So I told him, actually, you know what? When I was with Lord Narayan, he was threading an elephant through the eye of the needle. And the cobbler became even more ecstatic. And Narada said, well, hang on. Can you, what do you think of that? And the cobbler said, oh, yes, that's wonderful. For my Lord, that's nothing. And then he gave a very nice example that in the seed or whatever sort of flower pod of a banyan tree, there are many, many seeds. Just one little thing. Many. And you can produce many banyan seeds. I mean, many banyan trees from that. So in other words, the Lord has put so many banyan trees into that pod where all the seeds are. So if he can do that, then putting an elephant through the eye of a needle is nothing. Just small time. So even though on a certain level it's inconceivable, elephant through the eye of a needle sounds crazy. But for the devotee, he didn't have to sit and figure out, well, you know, could he or not, or what about this and that. It was just very ecstatic, very blissful. So for the very advanced devotees, particularly, this statement in Mantra 6 applies. They can accommodate everything of the Lord. There's nothing which will confuse them or bewilder them. But rather they'll be very happy, even with these like diverse conceptions which seem to be, you know, one of them might be true, but the other couldn't be true. If one of them is true, the other couldn't be true. But they're both true. He's very near and he's very far away, like this. So in fact, this mantra 7 on verse 32 is also describing the characteristics of this very advanced devotee who is in this consciousness. In other words, he's in Krishna consciousness, or a very advanced level of Krishna consciousness. Yasmin sarvani bhutani atmaivabhut vijanita tatrako mohakashoka ekatvam anupasyata. One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? That's a very, very nice description. He's very blissful, very happy, indeed, and no illusion. And Srila Prabhupada makes a little reference, we can just note at the beginning of the purport, that this, as Prabhupada said in the purport of Mantra 6, this applies certainly to the Uttamadhikari, who is just automatically seeing things in relation to the Lord. He doesn't have to sit and think, oh yes, right, this is related to the Lord in this way or that. But it's just, that's just his vision. He's realized. But here in the purport of Mantra 7, Srila Prabhupada is also applying it to a Madhyamadhikari who is being educated in these things. And through being educated and developing knowledge, then as he or she is moving in the world and seeing different things and different people, then because that knowledge is there, then the Madhyamadhikari is not so spontaneous, or it's not automatic like with the Uttamadhikari. But actually he's seeing effectively in the same way that, oh yes, that's right, this is related with Krishna in this way. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter particularly, and in other chapters also, Krishna says that I am this, I am that, I'm the light of the sun and moon, and I'm the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras, I'm the ability in man. So many things, dozens and dozens of things. So the idea is that the Madhyamadhikari, or part of being a Madhyamadhikari, really, you would say, is that through being educated in these concepts, then the Madhyamadhikari
when the Madhyamadikari sees the sun, then he doesn't just think that, oh, right, there's the sun again. He thinks, oh, yes, right, this is a form of Krishna or a manifestation of Krishna's energy. When he sees some expert intelligence or expert ability in some special human being, then he thinks that, oh, yes, right, he's being empowered by Krishna. He's being given some ability by Krishna. So the Uttama Adhikari is just automatically seeing things like that. But the Madhyama Adhikari is also seeing things like that, not automatically, but on the basis of being educated and developing knowledge. And as a result, as the verse says, what can be illusion or anxiety for him? Even if there's terrible danger, then he knows, this is Krishna. This is Krishna. And he doesn't get upset. There's one conversation of Srila Prabhupada's in Bombay, I think, with one reporter. There was some war for some days between Pakistan and India, and the Pakistani planes were flying over Bombay sometimes, and they would black out the whole city. So in the middle of the interview, some planes came overhead, and there was a blackout. And the reporter, who was actually, because of the war, he was trying to elicit some political statement from Prabhupada, but Prabhupada wouldn't, he wasn't accepting the bait. He was remaining very philosophical and Krishna conscious. Then when the blackout happened, then the man got very forthright, like, you know, just see, I'm right, you know, you should take this war more seriously. He said, sir, here we see it now, right in front of us. And what would you do if a bomb dropped on your head now? Because the planes were up there to drop bombs. And Prabhupada said that if the devotee sees that, oh, here is a bomb coming to land on my head, then the devotee thinks, oh, here comes Krishna in the form of a bomb coming to take me to him. So in this way, what can be illusion or anxiety for a person like that? So, you know, Uttamadhikari is one thing, obviously. But even Madhyamadhikari, like a very good Madhyamadhikari, who's very knowledgeable and very attentive in applying his or her knowledge in Krishna consciousness, then where will the illusion or anxiety be? They'll always be very happy. Okay, let's go on to Mantra 8. Now this has, well, it sort of doesn't have a meter in certain... One of the lines doesn't really have a meter. Saparigach chukram makayam avranam. Asnaviram shudam apapa vidham. Kavir manishi paribu swayambur. Yatat. Tatyator tan vyadad hach chashvatibhya samabhya. Yes, there's something like that. Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, who's unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. So the advanced devotee realizes these things, or at least knows these things. And ultimately, the very advanced devotee realizes these things, or realizes Krishna, and directly enters the association of the Lord. So then, section 4, mantras 9 to 11, we say, the description is that there are different kinds, different types of non-devotees, and they achieve different, varying degrees of misfortune. In order to advance nicely, a devotee must understand both the wonderful nature of spiritual life and the defects of material life. culminating in understanding Lord Krishna's position as the Supreme Absolute Truth. So we're on page 43 with Mantra 9. Andanta Mahapravishanti Ye Vidyam Upasate Tato Bhuya Ivate Tamo
Yao
Vidyayam Rita. Those who engage in the culture of nescient activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. So they're the latter category are going to go to a place which is even worse than the darkest region of ignorance. Pretty heavy. In Mantra 10, on page 48. Anyadevahur vidyaya Anyadahur vidyaya Iti shushruma diranam Yenastad vichachakshire. The wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. So that might appear to be pretty much self-evident. But anyway, when we get to that mantra, we'll see that Srila Prabhupada explains it in a very interesting and very profound way. Mantra 11, page 54. Vidyam cha vidyam cha yas Tadvedo bayam saha Avidyaya mrityum tirtva Vidyaya mritam ashnute. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessing of immortality. So it doesn't mean you have to be half in Maya and half in Krishna consciousness. It doesn't mean that. But we'll explain later when we get there. So Mantra 12 on page 62. Antam tamaha pravishanti Ye sambhutim upasate Tato bhuya ivate tamo Yao sambhutyamrita. Those who are engaged in the worship of demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so do the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. So demigod worshippers and impersonalists are not appreciated in Ishapanishad, the same as in Bhagavad Gita. In Mantra 13, page 69, Anyad evahu sambhavad Anyad ahur asambhavad Iti shushruma diranam Yenastad vichachakshire. It is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and that another result is obtained by worshipping that which is not supreme. All this is heard from the undisturbed authorities, who clearly explained it. Again, it sounds pretty self-evident, but Prabhupada explains in a very interesting. And the last verse in this section is Mantra 14. So basically, these verses, mantras that we've just read through, they've been talking about knowledge, about ignorance, and knowledge and ignorance, transcendence and being in Maya, sort of contrasting them in a sense. And now Mantra 14 is going to explain about when you're in this position of understanding everything very nicely, how you become fully Krishna conscious and go back to Godhead. Sambhutim cha vinasham cha. Yastad vedo bayam saha. Vinashena mrityum tirtva. Sambhutyam ritam ashnute. One should know perfectly the personality of Godhead and his transcendental name, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it, and in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. And then the last section is from verse mantra 15 to 18, and here the devotee, the speaker, is appealing to the Lord for mercy. Apparently at the time of death, bring me to your lotus feet, give me shelter. So we'll read through these verses. They're very, very nice. Hiranmayena patrena satyasya pihitam mukam tatvam pushana pavrino Satya Dharamaya Drishtaye. O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence. Please remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee. In mantra 16 on page 91. Pushane Karshe Yamasurya Prajapatya. Yuharashman sammuha tejo Yate rupam kalyanatamam tate pasyami Yo savasau purusha soham asmi. O my Lord, O primeval philosopher, maintainer of the universe, O regulating principle, destination of the pure devotees, well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind, please remove the effulgence of your transcendental rays, so that I can see your form of bliss. You are the eternal, supreme personality of Godhead, like unto the sun, as am I. So it's not that he thinks that he's God, or, you know, the same as God, really, but qualitatively. In fact, this is a bit of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva here. Then mantra 17, second to last mantra on page 97. Vayora nilam amritam ate dambas mantam shariram amkrato smarakritam smara krato smarakritam smara. Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes, and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you're the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I've done for you. And finally, mantra 18 on page 107. Agne naya supata rae asman Vishvani deva vayunani vidvan Yuyod yasmaj juhuranameno Uyishtam te nama uktim vidhema. O my Lord, powerful as fire, omnipotent one, now I offer you all obeisances and fall on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you. And since you know all that I've done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins, so that there'll be no hindrance to my progress. So in this way, the devotee is surrendering completely to the Lord. And concluding Ishapanishad, and I'm sorry we ran over time a bit. I wonder if anyone has a question or comment. Bhattaji?
Can you explain that you have Yeah,
in the introduction.
Our identity is one of
Yeah.
So it's interesting
yeah.
because there we are spoken about, that we are Krishna.
Yes, we're Krishna.
More of material.
Well, it is. See, it depends which type of Varnashram Dharma. There's Daivi Varnashram and then Asuri Varnashram. There's transcendental Daivi Varnashram, transcendental Varnashram, and Asuri or mundane Varnashram. So, the thing is that when people are following Varnashram simply on the material platform and not as a means for elevation to God consciousness, then it's useless. And Lord Chaitanya himself in Chaitanya Charitamrita says, if you follow Varnashram like that, even if you're, you know, the most perfect Brahman or whatever, the result will be you'll go to hell. Not just that, you know, it won't work out so well or you won't become perfect. You'll go to hell. But then Daivi Varnashram means the context in which Krishna consciousness is practiced within the material world. We are unfortunately on the material platform to one degree or another. You know, some of us or you may be more advanced than others, obviously. Some of you may be total newcomers. Some of you may be quite advanced. So Lord Chaitanya also in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he makes the point that until a person is completely transcendental, he must follow Varnashram. And this is why in our movement, Srila Prabhupada instituted Varnashram, and we're following Varnashram. And if you're a brahmachari, even if you're a very advanced brahmachari, but you must act in that way, brahmachari, and householder, and sannyasi, and whatever, brahmacharini, Vanaprastha. Until you're transcendental, you must follow the principles of Varnashram. Don't start becoming independent and thinking you're transcendental. Now, you're a brahmachari, but you're thinking you're very advanced now. So you can associate with the ladies and, you know, like that, and you won't fall down. No, you must follow the principles. Even if you are actually advanced. And in fact, Krishna makes that point to Arjuna in, is it the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Am I right? Okay, sorry. He makes a point like that. That even if you think, because Arjuna is thinking, I don't need to be a Kshatriya. I can forget about being a Kshatriya. So Krishna responds in different ways, but one way is that even if you are actually so advanced, still you should act, do your duty. And then he says, even I do my duty. And he, if anyone's transcendental, it's Krishna. So even he performs his duty, means Varnashram. Yeah. So Varnashram is very important as a context for the development of Krishna consciousness. Just as a context, it's not the all in all. But it's the context in which we cultivate Krishna consciousness in the material world. And I'm sorry to have taken up so long and gone over time. And for tonight, read the invocation and mantras 1 and 2. Is not extremely lengthy. It's not like trying to do an overview of the entire Bhagavad Gita in 4 weeks, which we sometimes do. We have 18 mantras and one invocation mantra, so there's 19 mantras or verses altogether that we have to study, plus Prabhupada's introduction that we have to study over the next 9 days. So hopefully we'll get through it all. You'll be graded, of course, at the end. The grade will be based mainly on the test. Also, we'll be taking into consideration attendance. We can just start. See, we don't have a tremendous amount of time. Let us start by
turning in our overview book, turning to page 2. The heading there is Editor's Preface. And here we've just given just a very simple type of summary, you could say, of what we're going to be, what Ishapanishad is all about, what the subject matter is. In a nutshell. And in the first paragraph, we have given a little explanation of a contextual nature. What is Ishapanishad? Where does it fit in the scheme of the Vedic literatures? So we explain here that the Vedic literatures have a number of main subdivisions. First of all, there's the four Vedas, the Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva, with their corollaries, including the Upanishads. Then another subdivision. The Upanishads, in a sense, then are a subdivision of the subdivision of the total or complete Vedic literature. The Upanishads are a subdivision of the subdivision, which is the four Vedas. Then another major subdivision is the Puranas. And amongst the Puranas, the main one is Srimad Bhagavatam, most important of all the Puranas. And of course, we are all familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam very well. And then there, another main subdivision is the Itihasas. Itihasa means history. So within the overall sort of umbrella of the Vedic literatures as a whole, these are three of the main subdivisions. Four Vedas, then the Puranas, then the histories. And within the histories, the main histories, or practically these are the histories. As far as I know, there aren't really other histories. There's Ramayana and Mahabharata. And of course, Bhagavad Gita is part of Mahabharata. So, just
put a little screen on the board. We have four Vedas. And they have subdivisions, Aranyakas,
and the Upanishad, there's another division. Anyone remember the other fourth part? Brahmana, Aranyaka. I forget. There's a fourth one, subdivision. Oh, the Samhitas. The Samhitas. Actually, let me just... Samhita should go at the top. So you have your Samhita. Samhitas. Four Vedas. The four Vedas are divided up into these four sections. Samhitas. Samhitas means those parts of the four Vedas which are explaining about the different goals that you can achieve, mainly through Karma Kandya. You can go to this place, that place, and the glories of all these different places, and the glories of going to those places. Then the Brahmanas explain about the sacrifices, Karma Kandya sacrifices, which are involved in achieving these places which are described, and the different achievements which are described in the Samhitas. The Aranyakas, they give more detailed descriptions about the sacrifices and different aspects.
of the arrangements that are required for the sacrifices. And the Upanishads explain the philosophy behind all of this. So the Upanishads are very philosophical. Then, so that's one division, and then actually, strictly speaking, the Puranas and the Itihasas, or histories, these are grouped together, actually. They're grouped together. So we did say that there are three main subdivisions. Actually, there are really two main subdivisions, and these two are connected together. They're mainly historical, as you would know from attending many a Srimad Bhagavatam class, I'm sure, that Srimad Bhagavatam is full of narrations about different people and what they did. So, historical nature. But in terms of being historical records, the Puranas are a little eclectic, would be the right word, but it's not like you've got one Purana, any Purana, and it's telling one whole history from beginning to end, which is the case with the Itihasas, Ramayana, and Mahabharata, which are telling one story. Ramayana, of course, is the story of Lord Rama from beginning to end. That's what Ramayana is. And Mahabharata is the story of the Pandavas, basically, and, you know, their family sort of history and their fortunes and all that. But the Puranas, in a historical sense, are more eclectic, if you know what I mean by that. All different stories from all different times and places and circumstances and people, obviously to make different, certain specific important points. So they're historical in nature, but they're very much all the different little small stories which make up a Purana, they're making up, that they're establishing certain very important points. Like in the Bhagavatam class now, we're reading about Prahlad Maharaj. So that's historical. But there's a point there that Prahlad was such a great devotee that even though he was 5 years old, he was extremely young, but because he was such a great devotee, even though he was placed in the most impossible circumstances, but Krishna saved him, and he came out unscathed by the mercy of Krishna. So there's a point there that we should depend on Krishna. And Krishna will save us if we really take shelter of him. Or like in the story of Dhruva Maharaj, the point there is that, I guess in the end, the point is that nothing material, even the best material thing, because he wanted to get the whole universe, or even more than the whole universe, actually. A kingdom bigger than Brahma's. And Brahma's kingdom means the entire universe. So he really had some big material desires. But when he realized Krishna, then he realized that all these material things are just useless. So that is the point there. So there are 18 Puranas. There are 6 in each mode. Then there's 18 subsidiary or Upa Puranas. Then there's 18 Alpa Puranas, which are like subsidiary or something like that. So in this way, the Vedic literature, this is a very simple sort of scheme, but this gives us an idea of what the Vedic literatures, how they're structured. So Ishopanishad, where does Ishopanishad fit in? Did everyone mark themselves present, incidentally? Anyone still need it? Anyone not mark themselves? Sorry. Can you just Pass this back. There's one Mataji back there. It's not present. So if we look in the second paragraph of our editor's preface in the overview book, we refer to Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, chapter 7, verse 108. Those of you who have read Chaitanya Charitamrita, you may remember this purport. Prabhupada lists out all the Puranas, 108. I mean, all the Upanishads, sorry. 108 Upanishads. Actually, there are more. I've heard from, I'd be the right term, some Vedic scholars have told me that the idea is that each Samhita has this Brahmana, Aranyaka, and Upanishad. And I forget the number, it's something like, anyway, there's thousands, many, many, should I say, according to the Vedas, well, what is left is maybe another thing, but according to the Vedas, there are more Samhitas in the Vedas than are currently existing. Thank you. Thousands and thousands. And each Samhita, I think there's something like 100,000 Samhitas. Each Samhita has a Brahmana, an Aranyaka, and an Upanishad. Now, we have left only 108 Upanishads that are popularly accepted as being bona fide. 108. And in that list that Srila Prabhupada gives in Chaitanya Charitamrita, we find that the Sri Ishapanishad is the first of the Upanishads. So it is very, very important amongst the Upanishads, according to none other than Sripad Shankaracharya. We're generally not great fans of Shankaracharya. But anyway, for what it's worth, and I must say, this particular idea is generally accepted by Vaishnavas also. He says that there are 11 of those 108 Upanishads which are the most important. And in fact, in that purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada also makes the same point. He lists out the first 11. So there's 11 which are the most important, and Ishapanishad is the most important of those, or the first of those. Like you may have heard of Mundaka Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad, Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. These are some of that first group of 11, which is said to be the most important. And Ishapanishad's the first, so it's very, very important. And we make the point here that it is very important in that it gives fundamental definitions of many of the most important aspects of Vedic knowledge. So as we go through Ishapanishad, you'll see that, in effect, Ishapanishad is practically giving a very concise, of course, it's all very concise and succinct and very much to the point, but the Ishapanishad is giving a very nice summary of our whole Vaishnava philosophy. Very, very nice, actually. Who is God? What is our position? What to do, what not to do, and how to achieve the goal of life, the perfection of life. This is one of the occupational hazards of having our classes here, the children. Anyway, that's okay. So Ishapanishad is giving very succinct summary of all the main elements in our philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada's purports are very, very wonderful. Actually, the text itself is very wonderful, particularly at the end. The speaker, I don't know who the speaker is, in fact, but the speaker, the last about four verses or so, very, very beautiful verses, as he is very humbly throwing himself at the lotus feet of the Lord and begging for some mercy. at the end of his life. So Ishapanishad, the texts, the mantras are very, very nice, very important philosophically, and Prabhupada's purports are also very important and very, very nice. Prabhupada really elaborately comments on each text, on each mantra. You know, normally when you go through Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, there are lengthy purports occasionally, but generally the purports are not so long. To get a purport longer than one page would be a little unusual, perhaps. Something like that. But here we find practically every purport is 3 pages, 4 pages, some of them are 6 or 7 pages. So Srila Prabhupada really goes into the subject matter of each verse quite elaborately. And as always, in bringing out very wonderful and very important, and very essential points. So let's just continue on in the editor's preface. Now we're going to give a little, very, very brief summary of the subject matter. The nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is described. How everything spiritual and material and how everything spiritual and material is related with him. Then it explains that to be aware of this, or to be Krishna conscious, is the platform for a successful, happy life. Whereas ignorance of Krishna, and ignorance of Krishna's plan in any form, and the speaker of Ishapanishad describes certain of the main types of ignorance. So ignorance of Krishna and his plan in any form will lead to disaster. The speaker of Ishapanishad doesn't mince his words at all. He really, when he wants to make the point that something is undesirable or quite undesirable, he smashes. He uses the, what Prabhupada would call, or Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, the chopping technique. He just smashes them to pieces. Yes, so ignorance of Krishna's plan will lead to disaster. But if one dedicates one's life to understanding and realizing Krishna, in other words, the process of devotional service, then by Krishna's mercy, he may reveal himself to the sincere devotee, and then one can go back to Godhead. One can perfect one's life. So all this is graphically described in Sri Ishapanishad, culminating in the speaker's heartfelt surrender at the lotus feet of the Lord and his appeal for the Lord's supreme mercy. So even though the Upanishads are generally known for being somewhat impersonal in their presentation, we find that Sri Ishapanishad is very clearly presenting the absolute truth as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the process for approaching him to be bhakti, or devotional service. So that, in a nutshell, and that's a very small nutshell, but in a nutshell, that is actually the message of Sri Ishapanishad, the framework, you could say, of Sri Ishapanishad. And as we say, it is interesting, as we've mentioned here, it's very interesting that the Upanishads generally, those of you who have read a little extensively Srila Prabhupada's books, you will have come across many statements, a number of statements, in which Srila Prabhupada refers to the Upanishads, or in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya himself refers to the Upanishads as being very philosophical and somewhat impersonal. Somewhat impersonal. But, of course, we know that all of the Vedic literatures, even those parts of the Vedic literatures
which superficially appear impersonal, but they're all part of the process. It's like a systematic process by Vyasadeva to bring us ultimately to the lotus feet of Krishna. The thing is that in the very early stages, and four Vedas and with their corollaries means the earliest stages of a person's development. The four Vedas and their corollaries are, at least according to the traditional concept of what the Vedas are and how you approach the Vedas. So the four Vedas and their corollaries, they're more introductory. They're essentially, at least the Samhitas themselves, which are the main substance, like in a quantitative sense, the Samhitas are quite lengthy. So the Samhitas, as I understand, they're virtually all Karmakandiya. And when we refer to the, in the eighth offense, in the chanting of the holy names of the Lord, that one may think that the Hare Krishna, chanting the Hare Krishna mantra is like, you know, the same sort of thing as what is being described in the Karmakandiya section of the Vedas. Karmakandiya section of the Vedas essentially means the four Vedas, but particularly the Samhitas and the Brahmanas and Aranyakas, which are intimately connected with the Samhitas, all about the demigods and the glories of the higher planetary systems, and then how you can achieve them like this. So the four Vedas are really like, in a very traditional sense of how people would approach life in terms of the Vedas, the four Vedas, they're pretty much the Karmakandiya section, other than the Upanishads. And they're where people would begin. And then when they would advance a bit more, they would come to the Itihasas, and then the Puranas, and then finally, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the cream, the ripened fruit of the tree of Vedic knowledge. So the Upanishads then are part of that first section of the overall Vedic literatures, the four Vedas, that part. In fact, Ishapanishad is part of Atharva Veda, of these four Vedas, Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva. The Ishapanishad is part of the Atharva Veda, I think it is. It's mentioned in the Ishapanishad, Sam. So, because the four Vedas, being the beginning part of the Vedic literatures, they're more intended for beginners and people who will be contaminated in different ways, including having impersonal tendencies. So the Upanishads are designed more for people like that. So it's not difficult to interpret Upanishads, even Ishapanishad, in certain respects at least. Certain of the verses could be interpreted impersonally. But actually they're part of this greater presentation of all the Vedic literatures, culminating in Srimad Bhagavatam. So ultimately they're referring to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Srila Prabhupada, the way he translates and comments on Ishapanishad, he really brings out the fact that Ishapanishad, as the main or one of the main, at least certainly the first Upanishad, is really pointing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada is very expert at doing that, bringing out the real essence. In fact, one devotee asked Prabhupada one time, he had just read one verse, the devotee had read one verse, and had looked through the word for word, and seen in the translation itself that Srila Prabhupada had put the name Krishna that the verse was referring to Krishna. But when the devotee looked at the word for word, he couldn't find Krishna as such. So he asked Srila Prabhupada that, you know, like suggesting that, is it a mistake? You've put Krishna in, perhaps he wasn't meant to be there. But Srila Prabhupada replied that, no, this is my expertise. Krishna is there. Actually, even though, you know, in a very sort of superficial sense, he might not appear to be there in very specific terms, but actually he's definitely there. In fact, he's everywhere in the Vedic literatures, of course. So he's definitely there. And Prabhupada said, that's my expertise, that I can show you actually how Krishna is there. Otherwise, these people who are like what Srila Prabhupada would refer to as ABC translators. These ABC translators. Because Sanskrit is a language, and like any language, French or German or whatever it might be, you can learn it if you want. So if you're going to be an ABC translator, then it's very difficult to really get the essence. So, but with such an extremely advanced devotee as Srila Prabhupada, he is very nicely showing us in Ishapanishad how Krishna is there and is actually not just there, but is completely the focal point. So, now, let us see. I think what we'll do now is go on to the introduction. So, the introduction, we've given a little summary on page 3 of the overview book. You can turn to that also. In fact, this overview book, as you go through, you'll see we give a little summary of each verse, of each mantra. This is basically, it's like a little precis, you could say. A very brief condensation of the main points which are appearing in each verse, or in this case, in the introduction. The introduction is in the form of a lecture by Srila Prabhupada, which he gave on his first visit to London in 1969, famous lecture. So I've summarized it here. Like the first paragraph of our summary on page 3 of the overview book is a couple of pages actually of the introduction as it appears in the book. Pretty much, let's see, first 3.5 pages we've attempted to summarize in the first paragraph. I mean, this is really in a nutshell, of course, but that's what it's meant to be. Let's just go through the first 3.5 pages then, which we've summarized in the first paragraph there. So we are saying that Prabhupada begins by explaining the standing that the Vedas have, how important the Vedas are, and how we should view them. And how, whereas mundane knowledge is always defective, but Vedic knowledge is always free from the different defects which are there in mundane knowledge. So, Srila Prabhupada, the first couple of pages, talks about the defects. You should know there are 4 defects of a conditioned soul. Who can tell us what is 1 defect? Put your hand up and... Yes, Brahma? Sorry? Huh? Oh, to cheat others. Right, exactly. Thank you. Wait. I'll get someone else. One of the Matajis? Yeah. Imperfect senses? Yeah? Tendency to commit mistakes? Being illusioned, right. So these are the 4 classic defects. And if we analyze all the defects and shortcomings that people have, we'll see they fit under these 4 headings.
And Srila Prabhupada explains these four defects very nicely with very nice examples. The first one in the first paragraph is the tendency to commit mistakes, to err as human. And Srila Prabhupada gives a very vivid example, the example of so-called Mahatma Gandhi, Mohandas K. Gandhi. So Mr. Gandhi, so-called Mahatma, you know, there was one, I think it was Australian, actually, journalist, said that Mr. Gandhi is a very unusual person. He's either a saint amongst the politicians or a politician amongst the saints. Kind of enigmatic character. But common people who don't know very much at all, they were very impressed with Mr. Gandhi. So these common, ordinary people, they gave him this title, Mahatma, which has stuck. But Srila Prabhupada, in fact, just a few days ago, I was with one devotee in South Africa, and he was making a big compilation of Prabhupada's statements about Gandhi. There are hundreds. And Srila Prabhupada really didn't appreciate Mr. Gandhi very much. I mean, really. He actually speaks extremely strongly against Mr. Gandhi. So anyway, here Prabhupada is using Mr. Gandhi as an example, that on the day that he was assassinated, he was warned. In fact, what had happened is that, I think the day before, if I remember correctly, the day before, the same group of people who actually killed him, eventually, the day before, they tried to kill him also, but they made a mistake. Their idea was that there was this garden in between his residence and the place, little temple or whatever, where they would hold the prayer meeting. And he would walk at a set time from this residence to the temple through this garden, kind of open grassy area. So their idea was that from outside the garden, from behind the wall, they would just lean over the wall and shoot him. But they made a mistake. They didn't check it out in advance. And the wall was too high. So the fellow tried to climb up the wall and sort of hang on to the wall and shoot over the top. But it didn't work. And he fell, actually. And there was a guard or some person hanging around a little distance away. And this fellow fell and a bit of a commotion. So the guard came running over to see if he was all right. And he left the gun and ran. So the guard found the gun the day before. So they knew that there was an assassination attempt was there. And at the time of the prayer meeting, to try and get him when he's walking between the buildings. They knew that. So they warned him that maybe today, don't go to the prayer meeting. Or you can have your prayer meeting in the residence, but don't go outside today. And then Gandhi thought about it, and he thought, well, no, I'll go to the prayer meeting. So he walked out, and this time, the same fellow was even more bold. He just walked up to him, face to face, and went, Namaskar, holding the gun in his hands. Namaskar, took the gun, and from about 1 meter away, shot him. And that was that. That was the end of Mr. Gandhi for this lifetime. So he made a mistake. Even though he's a big, big man, and even to this day he's revered by so many people. But he made a mistake, and it was a fatal mistake. So, very nice example of that. Then, next defect Prabhupada talks about in the second paragraph in the introduction in the book is to be illusioned. And what example does Prabhupada give? Like, classic example of what the implication of being illusioned is. The fact that we think that we're this body. We all think that we are these bodies. Everyone thinks that they are their body.
and life in the material world is going on that basis. This is a very classic example of being illusioned. Then the third defect is the cheating propensity. And here Srila Prabhupada gives the example of people who take the position of being materialistic intellectuals or teachers, even though they, as already stated, even though they make mistakes, even though they're in illusion, but still they'll get up in front of an audience and try and explain reality their way. So this is cheating. In fact, Srila Prabhupada made the point that the word cheat and the word teach are very similar. You just take the T and the CH and switch them around, and teaching becomes cheating. You know, like some of you may even have experienced when you were at school, that they may have taught you about the theory of evolution, but not, they didn't teach you about how it's a theory. They more or less taught you that about the so-called reality of evolution. This is cheating, simply cheating. And then lastly, Srila Prabhupada says on page 7, in the middle of the page, lastly, we have imperfect senses. And Prabhupada gives a very good example about our sense of sight. We all have eyes, and someone may challenge us that I have eyes, and you're talking about God, so show me God so I can see Him with my eyes. And if we then say, well, look, I can't, right here and now, I can't show you God, then they may think, aha, we caught you out. You couldn't show me God. So therefore, they may think they've disproved our idea. But Srila Prabhupada gives a very nice example. Do you have the eyes, the type of eyes required to see God? So the defect is not that we can't show. In a sense, we can show. But the defect is yours, that you haven't got the eyes to see. If we did show. And Prabhupada explains that if you're in a room, at night at least, if you're in a room and the lights are on, and suddenly someone just switches off the lights, then you can't see anything. You can't even see yourself. You can't even see your hand. You can't see a thing. Because your eyes are not suited for that. But if your eyes are different, like I heard cats. Can cats see at night? I heard that. Something like that. They have some sort of little more developed sense of sight, so they're more easily able to see. Or if you have, there's certain types of glasses that soldiers use, I know, like in the more advanced armies in the world, and rifle sights, that you look through these glasses, and even though it's night, you can see more or less. At least you can see the basic shapes that are there. Or a rifle sight, you can look down and you can see. So by adjusting the circumstances, then you may get the eyes to see. So to see God is not an ordinary thing. There's so many things we can't see. We can't see the air, which is here filling the space between us, which we're all breathing and we're all totally dependent on for our lives, but we cannot see it. We've never seen it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So in this way, Srila Prabhupada establishes the point that we cannot be relied upon as sources of information on the basis of our own capabilities and capacities. We cannot be depended on. But the Vedas can be depended upon because they don't have those shortcomings. This Srila Prabhupada discusses for about the next page or so.
from the bottom of page 7 of the introduction to about, let's see, say about the bottom of page 8 or thereabouts. One way that Srila Prabhupada addresses, it's an interesting way Srila Prabhupada establishes that the Vedas, as a source of information, are better than we are with our defective senses and so on. Srila Prabhupada gives a couple of examples of things which we come across, particularly as devotees, and you could say Indian people, they also come across these things very frequently, which according to our sense of perception, our senses, and, you know, our normal capacities for evaluating and understanding things. Prabhupada gives two examples of things which, according to that system, we would immediately think they're no good, they're bad, and they should be avoided. Cow stool and conch shell. According to our senses, cow stool, of course, is stool, and everyone knows that stool is completely untouchable and totally undesirable. So cow stool, by so-called normal circumstances, everyone would just write off cow stool as being just another type of stool which we don't need. But actually cow stool is extremely pure. It's so pure, it's purifying. It's very remarkable. And that is described in the Vedas. Actually, it can be also seen by, you know, if you do an experiment scientifically, you can come to that conclusion. But by smell or, you know, looking at it, the average person would conclude, just on the surface, that cow stool is just another type of undesirable stool. But it's not. And similarly, conch shell. Conch shell is bone. And bone is very contaminating. If you handle bones, then you'll find that your hands get filthy very, very quickly. Because that's just the way bone is. It's just the way bone is. It's not exactly like you can clean it and then it'll be okay. It's bone is like intrinsically dirty, very, very dirty. So conch shell, it's bone. And the average person would think, oh, bone is dirty, conch shell is bone, so conch shell is dirty. But no. And again, it can be shown scientifically that conch shell is pure. And that is stated in the Vedas. So, of course, Srila Prabhupada here doesn't go elaborately into the subject from the point of view, like, say, that the Vedas are coming from Krishna, and Krishna's perfect, therefore the Vedas are perfect. He doesn't really approach it so much, not so much from that point of view, but he approaches it by giving these two interesting examples. That the Vedas contain knowledge which is perfect. And they are a better source of knowledge than we are. And then he gives these examples to illustrate this fact. It's very nice. And to sort of illustrate it further, in the paragraph right towards the bottom of page 8, Prabhupada gives like a social example that in India, even to this day, amongst some circles perhaps, that if people want to, if they're arguing on some subject, if one of them can get up and say, well, my point of view is supported in the Vedas, then that's the end of the argument. That will be accepted because the fact that the Vedas in so many ways explain things which are beyond our senses, but actually they're true. And they can be shown to be true.
Therefore, the Vedas are taken extremely seriously by people who are familiar with them and who have gone through them and put them to the test. So we can also accept them. This is the approach that Prabhupada is taking to establish the validity or the importance of the Vedas. And going on to the second paragraph now in the overview book, we talk about Shabda, we talk about the Acharyas. This is discussed. Actually, I think we'll just go on with this tomorrow. So why don't you all read the introduction tonight? Is that okay? And just see how the points that, as we've taken them out in the overview book, how they're fitting in, how they're being more elaborately described in Srila Prabhupada's lecture in the introduction. And we'll go on with that tomorrow. Any comments or questions so far?
It's mentioned in that there is three kinds of evidences: Katya, Anuman, and Sabda.
Yeah. Anuman means inference. To infer something. Like, what is the classic one? That somebody, man is mortal, somebody, was it Socrates? Or Socrates is a man, so Socrates is mortal. This is called a syllogism in logic, in philosophy, a syllogism. Three-step process of establishing something. Man is mortal. Socrates is a man, so Socrates is mortal. So that's inferring. Now, we have not met Mr. Socrates, so we may not, have put it to the test and proved it. I suppose to prove it, you'd have to kill him. Otherwise, you wouldn't necessarily know whether he was mortal or not. But inference means that he's a man, and that type, men, they're mortal. That is our experience. So therefore we conclude, it's inferred that Socrates is... Yes. Every fire produces smoke. There is smoke. There is a fire, even though you may not see the fire.
So what is the best way of being answered the question? When we give them to not necessarily accept the Vedas as an authority.
Well, who, they want to know who wrote them?
Yeah. Sometimes we use this argument logically to present the Socrates as the very superior to them. Superior in that sense. No Vedas. So where to present the other Vedas?
Yes. Well, you know, who wrote Huckleberry Finn? Who wrote Huckleberry Finn?
Mark Twain.
Oh, yes. Someone in the airplane the other day was reading Huckleberry Finn. I happened to notice. So Mark Twain. So, they haven't met Mark Twain. They're just accepting it on that, through the last 100 or however many years. Everyone has accepted that Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn. So we say, not only we say, but so many people say. Vyasadeva himself says that he wrote or compiled the Vedas. So, why would there be, other than that there's more time involved, which doesn't really make any difference necessarily at all, why would we think that it's less likely to be true that Vyas compiled the Vedas than that Mark Twain compiled or wrote Huckleberry Finn? It's just a matter of prejudice, actually. That's the problem. It's an attitude problem on their part. They'll accept Mark Twain. They won't even question it. Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn. But the Vedas, no, Vyasadeva, they won't accept. Anyway, like I said, Srila Prabhupada here is not elaborately exploring the subject, but he's just using, it's a very clever method he uses, that in the Vedas you find certain pieces of information. These are just two examples, they're not the only examples, by any means. In the Vedas you find certain statements that this is like this. Now according to your direct perception and so on, it doesn't appear to be like that. Cow stall. It's stall. So according to your direct perception, it seems to be bad. But the Vedas say, no, it's very, very good. But then you test it scientifically and you see, actually it is good. So there are many examples in the Vedas like that. Yeah. And this is the method that Prabhupada's using. And it's not really my intention to really go into like trying to justify, so to speak, the way, or the Vedas, but this is, in a nutshell, the bottom line, really. One of the Mataji's had their hands up.
In a short realization, the difference is not being right, and that he's trained. It's not being claimed that he's still living in the Vedas. I mean,
we... Well, I don't think we would bring it up, you know, too quickly in our discussion with them. I mean, what would be the point? What would be the point? You know, if we're trying to impress it on them, get them to, you know, accept this, that would probably be, even though it's true, from a sort of political point of view or whatever, from the point of view of argument, it would be a very weak, a very sort of, like a badly thought out type of argument. Even though it's true, you'd be arguing against yourself, in effect. Yeah. So, yes, you're right. It's pretty fantastic. You have to already have, you know, accepted it. Then for a devotee, you tell them, oh, Vyasadeva's living in the Himalayas. Oh, okay, fine. What's next? But, the, you know, some man in the street or materialistic intellectual or someone like that who's in there. Even Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was the first of our acharyas to really take up the mission of preaching to Westerners, there are certain writings of his in which he, of course, he's trying to establish Krishna consciousness, but certain things which somehow or other, it's like he can't avoid mentioning them, but they're quite fantastic. So in some cases, in some of his writings, he says that they're mythological. Yeah. So now, obviously, we don't think that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is in illusion like that, but it's some special consideration, because his audience then, you know, is much worse than even the audiences we would meet now, who we would consider bad. They were much worse. For Puranas and Alpha Puranas. No, Bhagavad Purana and Srimad Bhagavatam are essentially the same thing.
Yeah. So is it the number of
states? It's 18.
The number 18?
Yeah. You'll find that our acharyas, like if you read through Tattva Sandhava, Jiva Goswami is discussing the position of Srimad Bhagavatam. So he's frequently referring to it as the Bhagavat Purana. And even in Srimad Bhagavatam itself, sometimes it refers to itself as the Bhagavat Purana.
His question is, is it one of the 18, or is it like 10?
No, it's one of the 18. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the six in the mode of goodness. Of course, it's in pure goodness, beyond goodness. But in material terms, the best you could say about it is that it's in the mode of goodness. In material terms. Okay, so read the introduction, please, and we'll discuss the rest of it tomorrow.
Srila Prabhupada Kija.